kind of know really do communicate in what is a private setting. Because even stuff like this, like right now we've gone live, for instance, even though it's kind of private, evidently people are watching, so we change our behavior a little bit, and all of us, you know, slightly alter our the way in which we present. The only time when we can be definitely who we are is when we know there's no one there, and that I think is very, very interesting. So folks, if you didn't know, we're talking about this cool Twitter account called Tech Emails, I think it is. And it is a Twitter account that does nothing but harvest kind of legally disclosed communication between tech executives. And there was a really cool conversation between Steve Jobs and the CEO of Adobe, talking about recruiting and why they shouldn't recruit from each other. And it was a really short and sharp kind of alpha male exchange. But it was quite funny and very insightful to observe that. So anyway, I'd recommend you follow that Twitter account. Okay, cool. So welcome everybody to Brain Food Live on Air. It's episode 115. We're bringing it to you every Friday, no fail. And we're super excited today because we're talking about a topic that has got loads of people interested in. How do you plan and execute for hyperscale, particularly with regards to planning headcount? How do you design a strategy for that? How do you know what number is good? You know, when a CEO says to you, hey, we need 500 engineers, like, why? Like, why that number? And what do you do when you get that type of situation? So we've got some really interesting folks that I think have had that experience before that are going to come and share with us that knowledge. But before we kick off, let's just do a quick sound check as we usually do. We are multicasting this, so we're on Crowdcast. So for the folks who can hear me on Crowdcast, can you please just let me know in the comments there whether that's okay? Sound is okay. I'm now default using the Bluetooth headset now. No more wired headphones, I'm afraid. It's going to be this. So hopefully that's going to be okay. And we are also broadcasting this on LinkedIn. So LinkedIn, are you there? If you are, please let me know. Once again, I have a black screen. It's like, I think there comes a time when I can no longer do this show via a laptop. And I actually need a proper computer to be able to present the information I need to see. LinkedIn, are you there? Can you hear me? Give me a sign if you can. Yes, no, maybe. Something like that will do. And we're also broadcasting this on Facebook, the Facebook group. So if you can hear me there, let me know. Be good to know whether the audio is okay. Okay, so we're getting a few people saying audio is fine. I think that's more or less all good. Okay, quick one to our sponsors. Thank you very much to our returning sponsor this week is ChartHop. ChartHop are a really interesting business, I think, in a space that is so, it's burgeoning. It's a new space that we can no longer ignore. People analytics, like, do you understand the talent in your business? You can't rely on an org chart and a sort of a yearly performance review. You actually need to know exactly who is doing what skills they've got, and what relationships they have. ChartHop basically visualizes the real relationships that you have within your business, and it's going to help you and your boss make better decisions. So I'd be surprised, actually, if ChartHop wasn't a kind of a useful tool for this type of situation. I've just shared the link there. Check them out, chartup.com. I think they raised like 20 million quid recently. They're the type of next generation technology. It's really exciting to get on with. Anyway, let's welcome our co-pilot for today, because we've been upgrading Adam really successfully recently. He's been gone for a couple of weeks. And we're delighted to welcome back Alla Pavlova. Alla, how are you doing?
Hey, everyone. Hey, great in Amsterdam, so can't complain.
Indeed. Doesn't the weather make a huge difference? We've been struggling with, you know, very intermittent weather in Europe, and then hopefully the sun is shining and it's blue skies and we're looking good. So that's great stuff. So Alla, let's throw the question over to you, actually. And I'm not even sure whether you're qualified to answer this. I know I'm not, right? So I'm like, straight away, I'll tell you, I know nothing about hyperscaling. I actually know nothing about headcount planning. I've got to be honest. Like, my experience is basically, CEO says, go and staff up that team. And I, yeah, boss. Yes, boss. I'm going to go ahead and do it. So I'm that type of recruiter. So pretty low, low strategy type person. But I just wonder whether you've got any experience of, you know, designing a plan with regards to headcount and strategizing that out. What do you know about this, Alla?
Yep. most of my, let's say, career, most of the companies I worked for, they were startup scale-ups, and it was either before getting the funding or it was after getting the funding. And yeah, hypergrowth is like usually something that happens right away when you raise the money. And usually I experienced that the hiring team, the founders or the CTOs, they were creating some kind of plan, very ambitious, like, as you said, hundreds of people. And then they were hiring agencies, interim recruiters, everyone to make it happen. And then I saw here I can help them to give them instruments, to give them some knowledge of the markets. Do you actually need that many people? How you can actually adopt them and onboard all of them? Because it takes the time of your team to help the people to get through your, I don't know, products, etc. So yeah, I'm happy to share a lot of insights. And I've been in a situation when you have 6 months, you need to hire senior 100 software engineers. Do whatever you want, as much money as you need. Do it, because otherwise you're not going to have the second funding. So yeah, that's what I've been through.
And actually, that's one of the things we should talk about. Like, how much is the recruiting basically driven by the requirement to raise the next round? Because you're on this type of cycle whereby every single indicator of success is these like huge numbers. And it's kind of a weird position for recruiters to be in that haven't had this experience before, when, you know, literally there is a number to hit irrespective of, you know, functionally whether these people have got work to do. And that's like a really interesting way to think about recruiting and you know, what tech startups and scale-ups are all about. Anyway, let's bring on some of our guests here. We've got some amazing people we want to introduce, and we're going to try and bring everyone on at the same time here. So hopefully we can do this. Christ, I should have really practiced Robert's name, but I'm going to have to mangle it when he comes on screen. I beg your pardon, Robert. He's going to have to help us with that, actually. Why do Polish?
As a co-host, I will just quickly, like, because I need to work this role. So are we going to discuss the last week letters that you sent? So
oh, shit. I totally forgot about that.
For a reason. Yeah.
give us the one thing. Give us the one thing we should talk about.
One thing. Okay. So this was shared by many, many teams, recruiters inside. So I'm going to share it in the chat quickly. One thing. It was in Twitter, so let me share it. Basically, this is a new old way how you can actually add all the articles in one thread. And so I would like to say to you, it was very helpful. It was very easy to go through. So basically, how do you hire women into engineering? And all the thread is full of amazing articles that you can go through. I love the idea.
That was basically my commitment to follow up Brain Food Lives with a Twitter thread of that type, basically. So I'm going to try. I failed last week because it was way too hard, like the ethics of AI, like how literally I have no clue. So I wasn't able to stitch anything together there. But today I'm going to hope maybe I'll replay the chat and see whether we can push on and do it. But yeah, if you're interested in this type of stuff, folks, by the way, follow my Twitter account. Also, I'll be tweeting about the Euro 2020, so you know, you got to be ready to deal with that as well. But there will be once a week huge Twitter thread on that, and that would be right. Okay, so Sana's struggling to get on. That's okay. I know she's kind of had some internet problems, but let's get our guests on. We've already got Robert and Matthias. Robert, start with you. Who are you and what it is you do, sir?
Hello, everybody, and warm welcome from Berlin. It's also sunny here, which is a great joy to all of us. So I am a head of talent acquisition for TaxFix. I've been there for the last 2.5 years.
Great. And Robert, I need to, basically, I was going to try your second name. It was like really intimidating, but I tried to do it, but I this one is too hard. Can you tell us how you pronounce this?
It's also, it's always a tree. That's why I just go by Robert, but it's Krzyżaniak, if anybody wants to give a swing.
Krzyżaniak?
Krzyżaniak.
Krzyżaniak.
Yeah, probably as good as it gets.
That's embarrassing. I do apologize. I'll practice. Okay. Moving on to you, Matthias. Matthias, who are you? What it is you do, sir?
Yes. Hello, everyone. My name is Matthias. I'm a director at the moment, and yeah, huge fan of the show, right?
Yeah, fantastic.
Hey, Robert.
And I think you two know each other, which is great. Sanna Goslinger is going to join us hopefully in a moment. But don't worry, Sanna, if you can't make it. I know sometimes it's very difficult to get through. Anyway, let's talk about where we're at. This hypergrowth scenario, I think you two definitely have this experience. You know, when companies have literally like raised a ridiculous amount of money and suddenly there is this like ridiculous requirement to hire at volume. Can you take us through an example of where that's happened? I know, Matthias, that's happened recently for you, but Robert, go to you first on this. Give us a recollection of a circumstance like that.
Sure, and that probably was my joining into TaxFix and kind of why I got hired. And I still remember the couple of the first day when our CEO and CFO came to us saying, "Hey, I know it's your first week, but we just signed Series B and we're going to quadruple the business this year. So we're going from like 80 to 360. So here you go." It's an interesting challenge, but something that how we tackle it and how we try to really go about it is to really adopt a skeleton of what would be an SWP process. So very kind of easily, you know, where do we need to scale? Like, what is the top level ambition? What is the goals? How many each team going to grow? And from that ambition, we then drive it down to the team saying, okay, just, you know, if we need to do this much in those teams, you know, how much in this individual team do you need? So building that bottom up kind of resource planning, bottom up headcount planning to match that ambition. Ideally, you meet somewhere halfway in the middle, and then from them onwards, it's really all about planning and really
very, going. Very quickly on this, Robert, how long did this period of planning take? Was it like a big project to do, or did you have to just roll it out in a couple of days and think, right, we're charging forward? Like how long was the period before you started actually going externally to candidates?
So the first one was super short. We were like, okay, guys, we just need to do this. So it was kind of around maybe 2 weeks time even when we were just, okay, this is the headcount. This is what we split. And this is what we're going to build the hiring plan from. Like now it takes probably a month. We build it into a quarterly exercise when we try to have a rolling 12-month plan every quarter to have all the headcounts plan for the next year. But initially it was just super short.
Yeah, very interesting. Okay, we've managed to get Sanna on to join us, which is fantastic. Hello, Sanna, how are you?
Hi, I'm very well, thank you. Thanks for your patience.
No, that's totally okay. Can you quickly introduce yourself? Who are you? What it is you do?
Of course. So I'm Sanna Goslinger. I currently am a director of talent at Marathon VC here in Athens. We have left Athens today because we had a massive heat wave. That's why I had some internet connection issues here. But before that, I was in Berlin and worked at various startups, starting with Sociomantic Labs, kind of building that team out. And then after that, when they were acquired by Tesco, I then moved over to Wayfair, which I think some of you may know as well, a large American e-commerce player that started very small, 25 people in Berlin. And when I left, I think we were about 2,500 people in Europe. So I scaled in 5 years quite quickly. And after that, I decided to go to work a bit more here in Athens, back and forth between Berlin. I joined a company called Hotjar, which was completely remote even before the pandemic. and from there on, actually then got a little baby and last year and decided that actually wanted to stay longer in Athens and integrate myself here in the community. So I joined Marathon and it's been great since then. Yeah, so now helping many of our portfolio companies to really expand and grow as we talk about hyperscale. Yeah,
that's actually really interesting about the prospective working VC side. Are you operationally involved in recruiting these people? Are you providing advisory support to those businesses that already have recruiting teams there?
Sure, I would say it's a mix of both. So with certain roles where they're maybe their current recruiters or their HR team is having difficulties, I would provide support as well with recruitment or get them into the direction of working with particular agencies that could recruit those positions for them. And then we're talking particularly at times certain difficult tech positions or executive recruiting. And on top of that, doing a lot of advisory. So really focusing on, you know, are they taking the right, making the right roadmaps? Are they kind of head of steering the company in the right direction? So it's a mix of both, I would say. Yeah.
Yeah, fantastic. Okay, cool. Let's point the question I asked to Robert to you two, Matthias and Sana. You know, when you get the news that hey, this has happened, like what is the immediate sense that you have? The pressure, the things that you got to like do. The first couple of things you have to do to make sure that you're not making like very early errors, because when you do make an error at the start, I think they can cascade through the process and can be very damaging. So thoughts on this? I mean, Matthias, probably most obvious go to you with this, because Beamery have just raised however many, 80 million, 100 million? I don't know, something ridiculous, right?
Yeah, it's 138 million.
Oh, we've lost Matthias a little bit.
Oh, can you hear me again?
Yeah, you've come back. So, okay, Abacar's come to you and said, right, 138 million's in the bank. Now what happens? Like was there already an existing plan that you just press go on, or is it now a case of look, let's figure out how to scale up this company to deliver against the value that you've just raised on?
Yeah, let me know if you can hear me all right. Otherwise, I can turn off my video. Funny enough, I was already early on before the investment happened at Beamery, and I could already know and execute and start. We didn't really know how much money we would raise, but that we would raise a lot of money and then we could plan against it, right? So I think what really, really helped us there is the combined effort within the departments to really nail this down, to really say what you just said, Hung, 60 people in engineering or 100 people in engineering, when will this happen? Or what time, what location, what level, and what are we optimized for? What kind of teams, what kind of setups? And this really, really helped us to get some traction there and actually, you know, enabled me as a TA leader to come up with a plan. Because if you don't have that numbers and with the leadership together, it's super hard to execute.
Right. So what I'm getting from this is basically the hiring managers essentially need to have the number in their own mind. When they've been given a task that they should know that their job in their particular function is to deliver against X, based on their history of delivering at a smaller level, they can estimate how many people are going to be required to do and deliver that result.
Yeah, I mean, it depends a bit in terms of scaling, right? So let's assume you haven't scaled over a certain period of time, then what do you do, right? If you don't have that historic data, if you say like, okay, 10 engineers, now you want me to hire 60 in the same time, how do you do that, right? And I think that is something that I have seen. It's of course super hard if you have not had the experience and now you hit the push ahead, the go ahead, right? And I think why planning is also so important is just imagine if you hire a lot of engineers, this means you need to hire also a lot of product managers or product designers at the same time, right? You cannot just look at this in a silo perspective. You need to combine everything together in order to say, if we hit this amount of engineers, this is then when it triggers the product manager role. This is then when it triggers the product designer role. And this is very, very important that we have a holistic view around what kind of business strategy we execute on.
That's a really interesting point. So you're saying there's jobs are contingent on other roles being filled. Of course they are. So you can't treat every job as kind of uniquely separable. If you hire X number of these people, there's going to be like a management required at least, right? Or there's going to be some other function that does this, that, and the other. So that's very interesting. So I guess a lot of time is to do this future projection. How do you do that? Is it, again, pretty basic with conversations with hiring managers? This is just basically like a requisitions series of requisition meetings, isn't it?
Robert, you want to go ahead?
I was just wondering who it is the question this is for. Yeah, it's I guess the problem with planning is twofold. Like, you either can like try to plan very, really far in ahead and really not let it be very robust and kind of agile in the moment, or you try to be super agile because all the things really change in hyperscale. Like the plan, you have plan A, and then 2 weeks later you have actually plan A.1, and then there is A.2, and you know, and it is all just kind of going. So it's really finding that balance between like how far ahead can you plan with long-term planning, so you can build, you know, TA capabilities, capacities, you know which teams will grow, how much you can, you know, get agencies on board, get the RPO going, versus how much can you actually allow the freedom of individual departments, individual teams, you know, constantly changing, constantly adding. And there is just happy medium there somewhere. What we have done, we have decided that, you know, every 3 months we have a rolling 12-month plan. But between those, there is a possibility to actually go in, change it, get those things approved, which gives us enough structure to work with, but also gives the business ability to kind of change and adapt the plan as we go.
Very cool. So for folks who don't understand that, rolling 12-month plan updated every 3 months so that the TA team can always project out 12 months. And I guess the hiring managers can also project that out 12 months, but it's updated. I guess that must be a very important meeting, actually, to get back to it and say, right, are we changing? Are we adding? Are we taking away?
Maya, Ed is a person who was in a situation like a Mohenzon in a way, like these are the roles that you're going to scale. I saw that it's very important to engage people who are going to actually deliver it and ask their opinion, like what are the insights in the market. And I saw that planning is a little bit disconnected from the capacity of the interviewers, because, of course, I can bring you hundreds of engineers. I will find a way with all the RPOs, with all the interims. But your team is ready. So do you have enough time to interview? So the KPIs, this is something that I found very helpful to take into account when you do the planning. How much time now it takes already to close down the roles, how many recruiters you have, because also if you have many recruiters, they should have recruitment coordinators. I don't think that I will be able to do admin work, do the hypergrowth, and but it is going to be stressful.
There's a couple of really interesting points there, Ala, particularly this idea of assessment load. Like if you've got like engineers that are doing the interviewing, doing the assessments of some type, there's a finite amount of time they can do that. Firstly, they have other jobs to do. Secondly, have we trained these people to do that? You know, are they comfortable with what we're asking them to do? And then of course, there's a point where, you know, their tolerance, their ability to actually deliver at quality is going to degrade, because they may just be thinking, I got other crap to do. I've just got to quickly yes, no this person, and off you go. And that's not even talking about, you know, issues like equity, diversity, and all those types of things, which, you know, you need to really have baked in at the beginning. But you add on this time to hire pressure and this assessment pressure, that's going to just trigger outcomes that are going to be probably not great. So how do we deal with that? Like, do we figure out how many interviews an engineer can do per week or something? I mean, how does that work?
Yeah, I think this was lovely, because that's exactly what we did. We looked at like the funnel, right? And the data that we had were like data points that we say, okay, not so many people involved, maybe not well trained. So the estimate and the data we will update, and the prediction that we make as we're getting better and better the more we proceed in terms of assessment. But at the same time, I think to your point is we need to look at talent maturity, right? So how much or how mature is an organization to hire? How much of a culture do we have? How much of the people that are involved, like especially in the beginning? Yeah, most of the time when hyperscale hits, recruiting teams, talent teams are not prepared, because most of the time they are, first of all, not completely staffed, right? And now then everybody starts with agencies and throwing money at agencies. Not saying that it's wrong, right? But what I'm just saying is you need to be prepared and have a game plan to, okay, finally I have the numbers. Now, how does the growth of my talent team looks like, and who do I need to hire first, right? We'll come to that question later, but I think it's super key, because if you do the right things in the beginning, you have spillover and synergy effects later on.
I think I agree with what Matthias is saying completely. I think, you know, no company is really completely ever ready for hyper growth. And you need to kind of at that time decide for yourself what's important for us now to be able to achieve that as best as we can. Because yes, we usually know when we're going towards a round of funding. The amount we don't always know, but we have a figure of what approximately we might want to raise, right? And where we would like to grow. So having those plans ready is definitely really important to ensure that, you know, we can grow in those directions. And we should say, okay, if we get X amount of funding, what's that going to be? If we get X amount of funding, then what's the plan going to be? So have those different examples of what that can be with depending on the funding as well and where we want to go. Having said that, I think, you know, you need to prepare the whole organization for this when it comes to recruitment. Because the recruiting team, the TA team itself, cannot carry it, as Matthias was saying already, you know, by themselves. And to give you an example, I remember when we were going through hypergrowth at Wayfair, what the management team had actually done is say to everyone that on Fridays, every manager and their teams were going to be recruiting for their teams. They were going through their LinkedIns and they were spending time to really focus on who are we going to talk to, who can we see that's in our network. So it really came from the top to say we all need to be involved in the recruitment for our teams and not just the TA team. Because as Ala was saying as well, you know, you may not have enough coordinators, you may not have enough time, but people need to understand if we need to scale, then that means a large amount of your time. And that's not just TA, but the entire organization is going to spend on actually recruiting people for their teams. And I think this is something that's really important during hyper growth. If you're not all in it to go for it, it's going to be extremely difficult.
You know what? That sounds so important, Sana. I appreciate you bringing in that insight. And what an amazing concept from the top to say, you know what, one fifth of everyone's time is on recruiting. Down tools, you're recruiting. And then that suddenly switches everyone's minds to it. There may be circumstances. Are there circumstances where that doesn't happen, where the CEO, C-level, they do see TA as being responsible for it, and they throw it over to you, you know, don't bother the engineers, they got to build the tech. How do you have a conversation with the C-level that kind of approach is going to ultimately slow things down?
Absolutely. Anyway. I think also with very small companies, right? So for Marathon, for example, we invest right now in seed stage. We're at seed stage often. So a company like Beamery is much larger, already has quite a lot of managers that are knowledgeable, that have maybe even done this before, hyperscale. But many of the companies we fund, there may be 10, 15, 20 people, 30, maybe 40 at max, and they need to scale very quickly then. And I think this is where you really need to talk to them about, you know, what that will do for them to really put their time into recruiting. You know, it's also where we say to our founders, pretty much 50, if not 80% of your job is recruiting. That's what you need to be doing. You know, being a voice of your company, but recruitment is extremely important because you cannot keep your hands in everything. You need to find people for your executive team that are really going to help you build out this company. So I think showing them and really advising them, you know, having them talk to advisors, having them talk to board members, having them talk to people who are professionals that have done this before to explain to them why, I think is extremely important to convince them also that this, why it is so important to do this.
Yep, fantastic. Go ahead, Matthias, you're saying something?
Yeah, I know. On the point that Sunny was just mentioning, otherwise then hire managers or look like at leadership capabilities. Leadership capability is hiring. Yeah, if you're in such areas that you work with and scale up, that's all the big tech companies do that, right? So it's part of your job as a leader to build teams, to grow organizations, and to perform at the possible best and create amazing candidate experiences. And if this is a part of your evaluation of your performance, I bet you they're going to be there.
Yep. So that's actually a really important point. If it isn't embedded within the hiring managers that recruiting is a key part of their job, then that's maybe one of the first things you need to do. I mean, as a recruiter joining a company, maybe awareness of whether managers are assessed on hiring and developing and retaining staff is a component of what you have to do. If it isn't there, then maybe that's something you have to argue for and agitate for, because otherwise you're going to be essentially just absorbing more and more pressure, at which point, you know, you won't be able to deliver against it, I guess. By the way, folks, I noticed everyone's like chatting away on the sidebar. Please continue to do that. If you have any specific questions that you want to have asked, though, and you want to guarantee they get answered, use the ask a question feature at the bottom. We'll make sure we definitely go to that towards the end of the show. Ali, you mentioned actually on the chat bar that one of the things that you did was to kind of demystify recruiting a little bit by working with hiring managers in the activity of sourcing. So it's no good just saying to hiring managers, right, you recruit. You know, they may actually not know how that works. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that action was? Like, what was the context of this?
Yes, I was starting to type the answer, but of course I can explain. So one of the things you can do, I've created the project and on LinkedIn Seed, Recruiter LinkedIn Seed, and I book the time. Sometimes you book with several hiring managers, sometimes like one, and I share the screen and I show like couple of ways how you can use the advanced search. First, of course, I like to ask them to look in the first connection. And sometimes, oh yes, I know this person. Oh yes, then I move them to, hey, let's have a look at the companies you particularly like, and so let's do the search. So basically, the sourcing is me, but at first I thought, okay, I have developers on a call. Maybe I will give them GitHub, Stack Overflow, something crazy fancy. No, actually we ended up doing things on LinkedIn just because it's something they already know. They're familiar with the interface. And so they put all the profiles on the project. It's very easy, one click. And then either I reach out to them or they reach out directly. And actually when they reach out directly, the response rate, of course, is high. So, and then I pick it up from that moment. They sometimes see me. And when I see that the person replied, I pick up it as well. So it fastened the process and so it worked very well. And actually they also see how much effort it takes to us. And actually I can also show them, hey, these are the LinkedIn insights. You see how many people you have these requirements, but what if we ease them a little bit? What if you remove this must have and make it nice to have? Actually, this is a magic exercise. They become a little bit more, you know, in a way, responsive.
You hear that, folks? I think that's just a wonderful example, because you're achieving multiple things in one action there, aren't you? You're educating the hiring managers on the job and the challenge at hand. You're definitely accessing a talent base that was there, but without you doing the joint sourcing, it would be left alone. They would not be spending time digging that one layer deeper necessary to find those folks. And thirdly, presumably you're going to get like some pipeline out of it as well. It's like as the ultimate thing is that you're going to get candidates coming through. So that seems to me, as Veronica mentioned, really good example of hiring manager engagement, but also with practical output in terms of candidates coming in. And by the way, I think hiring manager outreach definitely superior to recruit outreach, right? Does everyone agree with that? 100%. Yeah.
Absolutely.
That's.
I think also to what you were saying with Alice saying, you know, it's not even the second layer; it's even the first layer. You know, you ask them, "Hey, do you know someone?" Everybody, kind of, every manager also knows. Yeah, I'm supposed to be recruiting. I probably have people in my network, but what they usually do is just work with the recruiters to do things. They're not actually actively looking themselves. And in that, they actually take a look to even see just their first level connections, for example. They'll probably be like, oh, I didn't think of that person. Oh, I didn't think of that person. So it's really, even if you go not super deep, it's super helpful to do. And for what Alo was saying as well, I think one of the mistakes that's made often is to not have that first really in-depth talk with the hiring manager about what's the nice to haves, what's the must haves, and then you end up with so many profiles and none of them really match, and you're wasting a lot of time. So with hypergrowth in particular, getting that first step is so important. Make sure you understand very well the profile, but also that the hiring manager understands the profile. So sometimes they might not even know it so well themselves. So help them to understand what is it that they're really looking for.
Yeah, really interesting. And it's a simple kind of question of a recollection, isn't it? Like we have too much information in our heads, and our ability to retrieve it is not very good. So you as a recruiter have got to help your managers access the connections that they definitely have. How many times should you do this? Is this like you do it at the start of every job, or does it become like just an action that you train the managers a little bit to say, okay, this is what I need you to do. And then, you know, you kind of delegate it to the hiring managers to do.
I never managed to delegate them, to be honest. All the time you make them excited about that. Sometimes you say, hey, we actually hiring the person from your network. And I think there is no like consistency that I had, but at least once a month to catch up on the profiles, just to sit down, especially when I have problems with the people passing through the pipeline, I would do this exercise again, using it for the opportunity to negotiate on the requirements. But yeah.
Let's talk about this delegation to hiring managers idea. Is it a good idea to push the job back to the hiring manager as much as you can? To say, you know what, I'm a recruiter, I'm gonna help you recruit for your team, but in the end, you're the person that's gonna, you know, do the discovery of the candidates, you're gonna do the outreach, I'm gonna, you know, provide the moral support, so to speak, or the infrastructure to make it happen. Is that something that's a viable solution, a technique, should I say?
I think it's a team sport, right? Hiring is a team sport, so it shouldn't be one side or the other. It shouldn't be extreme. But I think, you know, if you want to, you know, as a recruiter, you don't want to hire people and to fill seats. You actually want to build teams. You want to build departments. You want to grow organizations. And in order to do that, you advisory in terms of, hey, I create an environment, I create like help, guidance in order for you to close the best talents that we have. And what do you need to do for that, right? So coach, train, enable. But I would not go ahead and say 80% of the time you are doing that. And literally, you know, the only thing that I provide to you is the ATS that you can use and everything else you can do on your own, right? I think it should be a level of collaboration on both sides, and then it's less work for both sides as well, right?
That's interesting. I've go ahead, Robert, you say something.
Yeah, I think what really helps is actually to state who's accountable for the hire. You know, I think there is a lot of hiring managers kind of think that TA is accountable for the hire, but actually in practicality it's the other way around. It's the business and the hiring manager that are accountable. And if you make that mental switch, all of a sudden, firstly, they understand a little bit more of, like you said, when you break down the work and you show them and you bring them in how much work there is, you collaborate a little bit better with them. And they are actually more present and more more driven to hire people. So that's what I would say, was just not really shifting tasks. I think that also is can be a teamwork, but stating that the business is accountable for hire is something that is really important to make this happen, to make the hyperscale actually happen.
Yeah, very, very interesting. I remember there was one episode where there is one dude who like swears by the idea of pushing the job as much to the hiring manager as possible. And he swears down he was able to do it. Ayan Space, if you know him, Dutch guy. By the way, if you're watching this, Ayan, good afternoon to you. But I'd need to speak to him at some point about this technique. But he was not recruiting, I don't think, for highly skilled engineering types of this order. He was recruiting scale of a different type of function, but apparently he was able to do it with a very, very small TA team. Now, okay, TA is not going to just delegate it to the hiring managers. We are going to have to take on a lot of responsibility. What does a TA structure, TA department look like in order to successfully hyperscale? I think that when you start off as a recruiter in any business, if you're the first person in, of course, you're going to be a 360 recruiter and do everything. Do you continue to hire lots of 360 recruiters, or do you start specializing? And if you do start specializing, how do you break it down? Like, what is the most effective way to get the volume? Thoughts on this? Sana, let's go to you with this first.
Yeah, sure. I think it depends a little bit on of course, the growth and what departments you're growing. So we mostly invest in, let's say, software companies. So tech is very heavy for us. And because tech is very heavy, I would definitely hire a specialized tech recruiter. Now, it doesn't mean that that recruiter necessarily maybe needs to be specialized in just Java or let's say just C++ or something like this. But I would definitely say that hiring a good tech recruiter for the majority of the languages that we would be recruiting for is extremely important. But the same goes for, you know, if you're many startups question whether they should kind of bottom up or top down, right? So do we first hire the exec team or do we first hire, let's say, the base team and then grow up adding exec in between? And I would say that, you know, from my perspective, top down, I think that Maddie Cross, who worked at Notion before, had done really great research on that most unicorn companies are actually going down, so they hire an exec team first. And with this, I think you really see that, okay, if that's really what you're looking for, then the question is, do we hire somebody who has executive recruitment experience? Because exec hiring is extremely expensive, of course. Or do we outsource that because we cannot find the talent to hire internally? So I think for me, it would really be focused on where are we trying to recruit, what areas are we recruiting most, and focus on that. Yeah. So I would specialize. I would not go 360. No, that would not be my recommendation, at least.
Yeah, and you're mentioning sort of the idea of getting exec level hiring first. I mean, the added advantage of that is that they may themselves be able to be good recruiters. I think a senior level person will not have achieved that degree of career path without having hired a lot of people. So you're bringing in essentially a good recruiting asset rather than just digging away and hiring like an operational person, which is, of course, you need that person, but they may not have a big network. They may not be able to assist you to do the recruiting. So maybe you hire some big hitters first that they can kind of take care of a few senior hires themselves, right?
And mind you, just to add to that, Hung, it's not necessarily, you know, when you don't have funding, that's, of course, very difficult, right? So we are talking about when you get to the point of hypergrowth, or when you're getting to the point of, let's say, your Series A, I would even say Series B. Otherwise, you know, you have very little to present them with, obviously. But nevertheless, you should find good partners who could be co-founders, who are maybe going to be in the initial term your exec team, and maybe they would step down from that at some point if they are not senior enough. But again, I think that seniority is important to have. Yeah.
Okay, so here's a question for everyone here. So this is quite interesting because the instinct would be we need to hire a bunch of senior people because they're going to bring a network, they're going to bring previous colleagues, they're going to help just knock out some of these requirements because we need to hire these people. Matthias, I totally get what you're saying. It's not bums on seats scenario, but there is an element that the hiring needs to be done. So, you know, hiring someone, bringing in a network is great. But how does that then marry in with this idea that, you know, potentially they're hiring people that are going to be very similar to them? There's going to be like a bias in recruiting. We know, for instance, in referrals, typically you end up referring people very similar to you. And that ends up skewing the workforce into quite a homogenous group of people. Is that a trade-off that we have to make, or what's a step we can take to mitigate against that? You got a hiring manager, he or she's got an amazing network, they're straight away at it and bringing people in. Like, how do you stop that from happening? You don't want that. You don't want to stop it from happening, but let's say they end up being very homogenous in their approach. Like, what do you do?
I think you should let people know what the consequences of this approach is, right? So I would even go further that, you know, hand-selected, very referral-driven hires will probably be the most expensive ones because, you know, people are like, hey, this is my buddy. I know him from there and I trust this person, right? And it's like, okay, cool. Yeah. And by the way, he needs another 15. Oh, okay. Interesting. So I think you can play this like that, but I think important is the alignment and what the consequences are, and then also showcase this to C-level, right? Because they would come up and say, hey, you know, we have seen there are some offers, they are really expensive. What's going on, Matthias? Is the market so hot? And then you will probably say, hey, well, listen, if you don't have job ads out there, because for those roles, because it's just kind of intransparent, backdoor conversations kind of style, then of course you shouldn't wonder of the consequences. So I think what is a good thing is to discuss this with people on the leadership level to say, but does that scale, by the way? It's not going to scale. And then on the other hand, I think the moment where you push a little bit more transparency and have more understanding of how processes are, you see, you can then as a TA function say, well, listen, these are the referrals, but I have two others that I sourced or that are in my funnel that applied. Look at them. Oh, by the way, they do it for 20K less. So was it really a hot market or not? Like, you know, you're kind of trying to push a little bit and try to figure out how can you push this to a certain extent, because every network and every people that you hire are not endless, their networks, right? And they're probably not higher every time they move into a different company, again, another 50 to 100 people, not gonna happen, right? So there is a normal end to this. And I think Series A and B can still do that kind of stuff, but at least on Series B to C and above, it's not going to work. It's probably works for 5 or not going to work for 100 or 1,000.
Yeah. So go ahead, Robert.
I think again, also another angle to this is also design the process in a way that you actually prevent this kind of bias of recruitment. You know, if you are lucky enough to have a very defined culture and very defined values, you can actually build a recruitment process that is very fair. That, for example, you know, you provide something like a cultural interview in that process where the culture ambassador that is completely independent of the hiring team, like super kind of unbiased, comes in and really screens these people for that culture fit, for those values, like how do they match the culture? And then it's not really, you know, hearsay, theirsay if they match it or not, but you have a, you know, as kind of clear opinion about it as you can get from somebody super independent. So there's a way to design this.
I remember you saying something like this in a previous conversation we had, Robert. So a cultural ambassador, can you explain to the people, like, can you explain it to me? Like, what is that person and what kind of role do they have in the recruiting process?
Yeah. So there is a group of people that have kind of been working actually at TaxFix for a bit that really, you know, passed the probation period and really know who we are and kind of are representative of our culture. We take them, we train them. They go through a very robust training of a couple of hours to how to interview, how to ask the right question, but also what is our culture. They go then through shadowing exercise, and ultimately they participate in the recruitment process as a culture ambassador, which is a very, very much at the end, final kind of gatekeeper, somebody that kind of meets every candidate, tells them a little bit about us, our culture, their journey. So there is a little bit of that kind of, let's say, selling the role, selling the company job there, but ultimately their role is to, in a very independent way, completely not connected to the hiring team, really define if somebody is a fit to our values, if they really are not only a culture fit, but also a cultural add, like what do they bring, how they're going to enrich our culture, and they fully empowered to actually say no. And if they say a no, it's basically the end of the journey for the candidate as well.
Right. So these people have right of veto, right? You've given them, so the hiring manager can't like overturn this. They can like hammer the table for a candidate, but if they don't pass the cultural ambassador interview, that's the end of the story. The person is not hired.
May I also look at the different angle as well? Like I see some questions from the audience as well. If you're talking about hyper growth, in my case, it was always also the speed of hiring, right? So if we have a person who is constantly also participating in each and every interview, and especially if it's one person, that will be a dangerous situation for me if I need to have like 30 interviews per week. So in my case, hypergrowth meant always super high speed. So and you can't compromise on the quality, so meaning you're the senior, you have to deliver them. And was it your experience the same? Like, is the hypergrowth always connected with speed, or you had something a little bit more relaxed?
Always. And what comes after is to then see, did we grow too much? So then you see that very successful companies then say, we have to let people go. And that's when you get a year later, you get that companies are letting go massively. People think that the company is not doing well, but that's not actually the case. What's happened is that people have now settled into their jobs, and we now can see whether we actually hire too many people or not.
So that's a very honest appraisal, Sana. And I think, I think it needs to be said, right? Because you're almost over-recruiting because you don't know what the company is going to look like. You have an idea, but all of these new people are going to come and really make a change. You know, when you go from 500 people to 2,000 in the space of 6 months or whatever, that company is going to change. So it's very hard to predict from 500, you know, what you're going to look like. So over-recruiting does happen. So that tells me actually we're going to like loosen the assessment a little bit. Tells me that, you know, we are going to just like put the foot down and get these people in. Let's be honest. If we're going to over recruit and test them whilst in the seat, you don't necessarily need to do overly too much scrutiny on entry. Do the basics. But you don't need to batter them with 6 interviews, for instance, that kind of thing. Correct?
Yes, and let's not forget that you also account for that you will think that some people will fail in their job. So you hire even more. So you might say, you know, we think there might be a failure rate of 5%, 10%. Some companies would say 20%. And so you account for that as well. And so this is why it often, again, it may seem that companies are not doing well a year later or, you know, but it's really about restructuring it again to make sure that it fits the dynamic that we want it to be. Yeah,
that's very interesting. I mean, obviously, there's ethical issues to talk about here as well, but we don't have the opportunity to explore that because we've only got about 10 minutes left of this show. So I wanna move our focus just a little bit. Firstly, we're going to go to the questions in a moment. But let's talk about sort of the piece of learnings that each of you have had through the exercise of doing this. Like, can you share with us a mistake that you made and you realized now after you've made this mistake, you know what, next time I have this situation, this is not what I do. I'm going to do it in a different way. Go ahead, Matthias.
I think, you know, what is key, and I don't know if I understood you, Hung, correctly with how sophisticated the interview process looks like, but I think you should have a game plan to your hiring approach. It should be structured. It should be consistent. And when you come into this temptation of hiring for short-term output and business needs, talent, and you not hire for quality. And that is then when Sana said, like, how many failures do we have? If 50% of those people leave after 1 year, you did a bad job in hypergrowth scaling, right? So you want to scale sustainable. And what does it mean, huh? Scaling sustainable. So my mistakes or my lessons learned would be, I would never push hiring managers for hiring a candidate if they're not 100% convinced, right? So because I don't want to hit my numbers, I want to grow in a sustainable them, even if it takes sometimes a bit longer, hire a best person to reduce the failure and cost of a fail hire, right? I think that is something that should be looked at, not just, you know, say, oh, hire 200 people very fast. You can easily do this with destroying company.
You know what? I think it's a really interesting point, Matthias. Don't pressure the hiring manager to just fill that number because it's going to end up just an attrition statistic down the road. There is an angle to say sometimes you get super cautious managers, though, that need to understand that every hiring is a risk and that you cannot, you know, be. I remember way back when, this is like rewinding back pre-internet days, I used to do some recruiting for a telecoms company back in the telecom boom. There was one hiring manager, god damn it, Terry, he just would not hire anybody. It was like nobody, and it turned out he was just a very cautious dude, you know, and it was like there was at some point where we had to go above his head and say, you know what, we may need to take away the responsibility a little bit because he won't pull the trigger on this. So there's an element of that as well. But I guess you are, the central point you make is correct. don't pressure the hiring manager because you're going to get an attrition issue. Okay, let's go to you, Sana. One mistake, one thing you won't do again, a lesson learned.
Yeah, I had to think of a second one because I had a similar as what Matthias had. I think the pressure, definitely. I mean, I think that, you know, it's difficult, right? You want to perform, and still often recruiters' performance is measured by how many do you actually requisitions can you fill? Whereas, you know, maybe we should actually be looking at how many people have you hired could are being retained for the next year or 2 years, right? So there should be different figures for that, perhaps. So difficult to say what else, but I don't know. I would even say like stupid rookie mistakes that you would have made where you did the wrong name to somebody that you reached out to and you just think, oh, this was so embarrassing. Things like that, you know, really double checking what you write, who you're writing to. Sometimes you're in such a rush, especially with like high volume recruitment, you know, that you make mistakes. You reach out to someone and you say, hey, great, you were working at, you know, Hung's company and so and so. And they were not actually working at Hung's company, but they were working at Alice's company. So these stupid mistakes cost you a lot because it, first of all, costs you the relationship with the person. So even if they were not interested right then, they could maybe be interested down the line. But if you've done something like this, you know, they just think you're kind of silly. So they probably won't want to connect with you again. They don't think you're professional. And building those kind of relationships again are really really difficult. So I think, you know, those are things that I think in the beginning, some of us as recruiters have definitely made that mistake maybe once, hopefully not more than that. But that's definitely one that I'd say, you know, when you're writing your personal messages to them, make sure you've got everything right. Read that again for another minute or two, because it can cost you a lot more than those 2 extra minutes of reading what you write.
Yeah, I think we have to be aware that the extra requisition load is going to trigger mistakes, and you need to be aware of that and almost manage, you know, plan for those mistakes to occur simply because you're being stretched. So that's super interesting. Okay, Robert, how about you? Give us a tip that you kind of learned through your journey, and you think, you know what? Yeah, next time this happens, I'm gonna do it a different way.
Yeah. I have also a silly rookie mistakes that that we done, because we talk a lot about here about planning. Let's plan, let's structure, let's do it this. But tracking of hyperscale, that's a completely different beast. And you know, when everything is happening simultaneously, teams are going one way, the other way, like we have plans changing, keeping it all track in one place so you can actually have an understanding of what's happening, where are you against the plan, where are you against this team, how many hires we made in this team, is actually key and essential. So planning is one thing, but guys, also just make sure that your tracking is also robust and on point to make sure that you're not going to get lost in the jungle.
Well, let's talk about that. There was a question. Let's go to the questions. A question by Anna Avecca. Anna, hi. She is a former guest of BrainFood, I think. What tools would you use to plan and track it? I mean, are we still on spreadsheets here? Like, what are we using to actually track what's going on?
I can also second that call. We've been also trying to find a great tool to plan hiring and plan scaling, and you know, cheats are seems to be like the thing. We tried a little bit with Notion, but then finance can use it. Those numbers are not transferable. So if anybody has a great tool, I don't know, Matthias, Sana, I'm super happy and super also open to find one.
Any thoughts on this, guys? Tools to use to plan and track? You can say Beamery, Matthias, that's okay.
Beamery, of course. No, but I think what we should always optimize. I cannot strengthen this point with Robert again. It's like, it's really, really important that you have accurate data. And this is also when we talk about talent teams and how to build talent teams, who thinks about TA, talent intelligence, first? No one. Right. And then at the second one, you believe tools will help you to the bottom of their data infrastructure. And then what I'm getting into is if you have a really good BI team and a data team available, build this within your Tableau, MicroStrategy, whatever. That's the tool to go for, because then you can manipulate and structure the data in that sense that you get all in once, right? You have Google Analytics, you have ATS, you have other tools that you can combine with, and then you have the whole dashboard and overview. That's my solution here.
You know what?
And to be fair, yeah, sorry to interrupt. to be fair, man, like if I look at all of our portfolio companies, they're all using an ATS system now. You know, I think 10 years ago when I came to Berlin, we were on spreadsheets. Most startups were on spreadsheets. But now I think a lot of ATSs, there's a lot, first of all. So there's really competition. It's more affordable also for startups. They often have like better pricing. You know, we have startups that have like 3-4 people that are using an ATS system. So I think that it's just becoming a lot more attractive for them. And to you know, what Robert was saying, tracking, keeping track of, and making sure you understand also where you are in the process of, with people and not losing track of that, even if it's a couple of hires you're doing, is extremely important. So ATS is just a must have, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think so. Probably there seems to be maybe either a gap or at least an awareness that there is potentially tooling that could be ideal to stitch different products together. I mean, we're kind of moving towards a world where interoperability is going to be a default. So it'd be very interesting space to kind of monitor to figure out, because ATS software is great, but that's only tracking candidates that are in funnel. What do you do with people that you spoke to? They're not in funnel. They don't want to be trapped because of GDPR or whatever, but you've got to kind of have a conversation there. What about interview analytics? You know, you've got a hiring manager, you know, Brian there in Department B, he seems to not hire anybody. Why is that? You know, oh, it's because his interview is like this. That's information you need to know. But I think right now it's like bucketed in different tools that are not stitched together. So exciting moment, I think, for us in recruiting tech. Yeah. Okay, let's move on to questions. Keep on going. We're going to go Amanda Clayton. Amanda saying, what typically is the size of team you need for amount of growth? So this is the classic ratio of vacancies to recruiters. We just need some numbers on this. I know there's a bunch of caveats, guys, and you know we can say yes, you know, with various conditions. But generally speaking, how many recruiters per role for hypergrowth? Robert?
Oh, this is a question for a whole another Chromecast, you know? Like, I mean, like this is a big one because we went through capacity planning year after year. Some hold, some doesn't. Like, there's this like golden rule apparently that every recruiter makes 3 hires a month and they should kind of have around, you know, 6 to 8 roles, but that is just too global. And then when you drill in, you know, our data hiring takes forever, million of candidates, you know, our in different teams, it's also super, super kind of individual. So it's really all depends how you really break it down, how granular you want to go. You can work with indexes, you know, how hard certain roles are to fill, like they required twice amount of usual work, or some role requires half amount of the usual work. So there's just kind of layers of complexity to really figure out. But ultimately, it all comes back to probably what we said, just use your previous data. Just see how efficient your company was, how quickly recruiters were hiring, how many roles they were hiring. Can we take it up? If we can't, you know, if we can only use this, then let's work with that and just try to scale it up. But is there really, I don't know if there is a magic answer, one for everybody.
Yeah, this is a very interesting, this is again where you might need some, I'm going to say it, you need a robot to help you with this. Like there's got to be some system that's going to be able to drag all the information out of all of the systems that you've used and then be able to spit out some numbers to help you here. Because how long is it going to take you to actually figure this out? As a human being, it's going to take way too long. Yeah, very interesting. The answer, Amanda, is nobody knows. Okay, let's move on. What are your views about setting up a sourcing function in TA? Yes or no? Quick answers to this. So a specific sourcing function. This is like not 360. You're just like everyone. Yeah, everyone's yes to that. So I'll let that you ask the question. I think you asked the question. You're giving yourself the answer. This is like amazing rhetorical loop there. Okay, let's go to this one from Victoria. Any magical recommendations to make hiring managers engage? Usually they're all strong characters. You know, they're saying, and that's true, you know, sometimes they're intimidating folks. You can't do whatever. What is a technique to get them to actually pay attention to recruiters, get them actually involved in recruiting, switching, activating them as recruiters? Thoughts on this? Give us a tip, Matthias.
I need to be careful what I say now. I think persuasion, influence. So I think create a story around, you know, do they wanna succeed themselves? And then start from there what it takes them to succeed in order to then collaborate. I think most of the hiring managers will understand that when growing a team and progressing in their career, they need to be successful. And in order to be that or to do that, they need to collaborate with us to be successful.
Yeah, I think so. You got to pitch it as a personal thing. Batting backwards and forwards whose responsibility it is. You say, listen, as a hiring manager in the modern world, you know, one of the things that's going to be good for your career is being an ace recruiter. It's a big part of your job. I'm going to help you be that person. And then suddenly, yeah, you're on side. Okay, I love it. Okay, so this is from Vinayak. He's saying, what are the best interview rounds for a company which is hiring 100 tech people? What are the rounds you are following? I actually don't understand the question, what he means by rounds. I guess this is about the amount of interview stages, let's say. What is the optimal stage of recruiting tech people at volume, 100 tech people?
As little as possible.
Explain, Sana.
I mean, you know, some have 8 rounds, whereas others have 2. Why can somebody do it in 2 rounds versus 8 rounds? What's the difference, you know? And I think nowadays, my partner is a software engineer. I think software engineers are so sick and tired of having to prove themselves in every test that they need to do that, you know, what are you really trying to get from them with that test, right? Do you even understand what you're asking them? So I think for me, it's really focused around as little as possible, but you need to understand what are you trying to get from the interview. And that is what you want to know. And to try and not forget that, especially when we're talking about engineering, you know, most engineers can get jobs everywhere. Why do they want to work for you, right? And even if they apply, you know, don't think like, oh, well, you applied to us. Why do you want to work here? No, still sell them the story. So I think it's important to get information as quick as possible through many means that you have. Look at their GitHub account. Look at what they've done, maybe open source. Look at what else they can have contributed to understand whether they're also going to be the right person. If you are going to ask a person that has 10, 15 years of experience in software recruitment to do a coding challenge for you, then why are they even sending their CV with, they have so many years of experience, right? I think there, again, back to what Robert was saying, it's thinking about that cultural fit, whether this person with the right skills is going to fit within that team. So making sure you understand how you're assessing those skills in the right way without wasting anybody's time.
That's it. Basically, the answer's 2, Vinayak. No more than that, bro. So if you're like asking too much, you're gonna miss the candidate. So there's literally no point. I mean, there may be exceptional circumstances. You know, we're not talking about exec level hiring. Maybe you need multiple rounds there. I get it. But for an operational person in a scale up, I think you got to be a lot quicker in responding to how quickly the market is going. I'm going to skip the other questions because I think we can go to them in a different way. I want to end with a final question, which I think is super significant, which is, in the post-COVID era, does that not make hyperscaling easier? Because suddenly you have a global talent pool to recruit from. Rewind back 3 years and you're hiring for Wayfair, you got to bring these people to Berlin. You got like a huge kind of logistical requirement to do that. Now, actually, hey, we can recruit these people from anywhere. You suddenly can make it happen. And at the same time, a remote worker that's always remote, maybe you can take down the effort, the assessment effort, for instance, and there's other ways in which you can figure out whether this person is a good fit. Maybe it's a 3-month contract. Maybe it's something you roll on over time. Similar to your rolling project plan, Robert, you don't necessarily need to commit to a full-time person because this person may not come into your office ever at any time. So distributed world, is it going to really help hyperscaling? Go ahead, Matthias.
If I'm now Spotify, Netflix, or all those fancy companies that can afford such a strategy, I think, yes, it's getting easier and easier to do that. I don't think that a lot of people have figured out now what their internal next step is of how they see themselves as remote, hybrid, or whatever. And then really then to hire against that is something that is really, I see at the moment, a thing. But it gets clearer once people commit and once people understand what is the right answer, what is the most people-centered answer to that question. And then a lot of things will happen after that, right? You'll probably see a lot of people one or the other. But pre-COVID, we already used to switch talent markets. We already understood that local talents is not the right approach, that you should look into how attractive a city is or how attractive, like, you know, companies are. And I still think, like, I don't want to change you, Hung, but like, I still think that this kind of culture, this kind of collaboration will still play a part within and not just be online.
Yep. Yeah, I totally get it. And we actually don't even know what software development might look like in a, you know, fully distributed state. I know there's some companies that, of course, have always been distributed in a certain way. Typically, they're companies that also produce distributed software. So they're kind of eating their own dog food to a certain degree. But what about a company that's transitioning from one to another? I think that's a different cultural challenge. Okay, let's end with your comments on this topic, Robert and Sana, and also Ala. Like, what remote working, is it going to change how recruiters deal with hyperscaling challenges? And if so, how? And if not, why?
I guess for me, the question is the acquisition obviously becomes easier. You can just hire anybody anywhere, just, you know, ship a contract to Colombia or you hired. But I think what we mentioned here is that failure rate, that attrition rate, because how those people going to get onboarded into company while they're remote? Are they going to have a great experience? You know, is there really the company culture ready to be remote? Are we great in written comms? Do those people going to feel really part of the team? What about the time differences? Like, I think that's the recruitment part itself maybe becomes easier because you say, hey, all of a sudden, you know, talent pool is really global, but really then that integration and making sure that it works, that you don't have to refill that role every now and then, that becomes harder, because that even happened for us at TaxFix. You know, we have to hire somebody and we were like, oh, great, this is so much easier. And then 6 months down the line, that person is like, well, you know, guys, I actually have been 10,000 kilometers away from you, didn't really get involved. Well, maybe I'm going to go. And then we have to kind of hire again. So that is probably the bigger question here.
Very interesting. Like, even tenure is worth looking at, right? I mean, I don't know whether any of you saw the graphic about how long any staff members hang around in the, you know, big tech companies, the FANG businesses, and all of them were like 18 months, 2 years, that kind of level. But I wonder whether in the distributed world, does that suddenly shrink, like aggressively shrink to 6 months, and, you know, suddenly there's a reluctance to commit. Final words to you two, Ala and Sana. Let's go with you, Sana, firstly. Remote distributed work, how does it impact hyperscaling challenges?
I don't think there's going to be too much of a change, to be fair. I think that what we see, because even when I worked, you know, at Hotjar, which was remote before the pandemic happened, it was still challenging for us to hire people as well. And we would hire them everywhere. And that's not just because of maybe tax reasons or for reasons of, like, that you cannot maybe hire them there because you don't have an entity there. So you need to hire them as a contractor, which they may not want because they want benefits. So, but beyond that, you know, if I look at it as well, and maybe we should have a talk again in a year, Hung, to see where we actually stand, because I think there's so many factors involved that can change this. Josh Burson just recently published a piece on, you know, what is this kind of hybrid model going to look like with regards to, or what should it look like and how can it look like with regards to working from home or working remote and not working remote? And, you know, you see it with most companies now as well, is that most companies are going to a hybrid mode, which just shows that not everybody wants to just work from home or work from anywhere. They want to also work in an office. And again, to what Robert was saying, you know, that brings things with us that shows, like, how do we onboard them? Sure, you can onboard them, but there is a little bit of an interconnectivity that people feel is lacking that you don't get when you work remote. Whereas, mind you, remote has opened up, obviously, so many opportunities for people who don't like those chit-chats, who don't like to have that coffee in the hallway with their colleague and who would rather just be productive at home and spend their time at home. But I think the flexibility is great. I think that it will help hypergrowth in the sense that, yes, it opens up more opportunity for people to choose where they're going. We see that now also that people are quitting their jobs now because, you know, they feel that they can now choose more of their jobs because so many more companies are remote. But where will we really stand next year, and will it have that massive of an impact on hypergrowth? I'm not convinced yet.
It'll be interesting to respond in exactly that time frame. Definitely. Okay, final word to you, Ala. Your thoughts on this concept of remote distributed work. How does that impact the hyperscaling recruiting challenges?
I personally think that hypergrowth is require a lot of creativity, and if working remote is something that will bring us more options, so that's gonna change it. I wonder if there are, like, you know, data scientists engaged in this kind of research when you decide, are you gonna be fully remote, are you gonna be hybrid version, is there any service run in the company? Because I hear a lot that people would like to work in the hybrid version, but all my friends, all people close to me saying, fully remote, that's what I want. And I wonder, like, where is it coming from? And I think the companies who can adapt to a decision that the every employee is going to make for themselves, like, we can give you fully remote, we can give you hybrid version, take anything, we can handle it. So that, I think that that's going to be a boost for hypergrowth. And let's see in some time if it's going to happen.
Yeah, I think it's just exciting times. I mean, I don't know whether, you know, anybody in the crowd agrees with me on this, but basically it's a very interesting time to be in this business. And having seen, obviously, very difficult year, every difficult 12, 18 months or so, this moment now is just, really loaded with opportunity. And it's going to be very interesting to see, you know, the experiments today are going to be the best practices to do tomorrow. And we've got the opportunity to experiment. So, you know, go ahead and do those things. Okay, cool. That's about it, folks. Sana, Matthias, Robert, thank you very much for joining us. It's been wonderful having you. We're going to say goodbye to you at this moment. Please enjoy the sunshine, folks. That was great. And by the way, thank you everyone who's joined the show. I hope you've enjoyed it. Ala, I hope you enjoyed it as well. I think, again, this topic is too big to have a 60-minute conversation.
Your audio just lost for a second. Yeah, I do agree that you're muted for some reason, but yeah, it is a big topic. But one thing I've noticed in the chat as well, should the recruiter be a hypergrowth recruiter to do this job? And in my personal opinion, you should at least at once, if you worked in the company that was going through the hypergrowth, it's going to change you forever. I still remember my first hypergrowth project when I had to be engaged in a lot of hirings, and should be fast, it should be quality, there's no compromising. And you have to keep yourself going. You have to have a lot of energy to go through it. So I do think it's a mindset, hypergrowth. So you should look into people who've been there, who've done it. I don't hear you for some reason, Han. You're muted. He's reconnected. Thank you so much, everyone. It was a great topic. It was a great learning process, and I saw a lot of nice and interesting questions in the chat, so I hope that we'll cover them.
Okay, I think I'm back. Sorry about that, everybody. But Ala's the person you want to speak to anyway. She's the smartest kid. All right, listen, that's about it. Thank you so much for watching the show, everybody. If you do enjoy this conversation, make sure you follow the channel. We're going to do this every Friday, so this type of conversational content, I think, really helps stimulate some ideas and give us some practical tips on what we might do as well. Next week, we have got an extraordinarily interesting topic. We are going to shift the focus as part of the global tour of Brain Food Live. We're going to go to a country that nobody knows anything about in terms of recruiting. That's right, folks. We're going to talk about recruiting in China. And we're going to speak to a bunch of people that actively recruit people in China, including a person who runs a job board out there. We have a leader of GlaxoSmithKline who recruits in for the China region. We've got people to do assessment over there. It's going to be really interesting to get to know a territory that, you know, has a very different way of operating. So if you're interested in expanding your mind a little bit, make sure you sign up for that. Okay, that's about it. Thanks again to our sponsors this week, ChartHop. By the way, fully relevant, it was very clear that ChartHop may potentially be the type of product that would be suited for hyperscale because it gives you the ability to just get heightened visibility as to what's going on in your business. And it seemed evident that in terms of the tooling people were using, it was still pretty much, you know, getting stuff DIY yourself, which, you know, isn't the optimal thing. So yeah, that's it, folks. We'll see you next week. Enjoy the sunshine.
Thank you, Han. Thank you, everyone. Bye.
Oh, by the way, Allah, sorry about failing to remember the bloody brain food review.
Yeah, I was, but yeah, I thought it's my job in a way. So you're testing me as a co-host.
It was.
Like, do I know my place?
I know. I totally forgot about it.
But you mentioned one important thing.
You know, I'm blaming my vaccine jab. So I had a jab in my left arm yesterday, and I felt okay, but now it's starting to hurt, and my head is hurting as well. So I think don't feel sorry for me. I'm just blaming, you know, I'm blaming public health as the reason for my inability to think properly.
Was a great chat. People enjoyed it. Amazing.
Cool. And you're coming back a couple of weeks time for how to build like social capital for with software engineers. That's going to be a cool one.
Preparing for that. Thank you. See you next week. Interesting topic about China. I'm going to be there.
Yeah. Take it easy, Allah. I'll see you soon. Okay.
See you soon. Bye-bye.